Hard to be having a Bible lesson without a Bible, so I had to take a moment to get it out. And largely it will be from 2 Chronicles chapter 20. That's Jehoshaphat's victory without a fight. In 2 Chronicles chapter 20, maybe we'll take time to read about it. It came to pass after this that the children of Moab and the children of Ammon, and with them some of the Ammonites, came against Jehoshaphat to battle. Then there came some that told Jehoshaphat, saying, "There cometh a great multitude against thee from beyond the sea, from Syria. And behold, they are in Hazazon Tamar," the same as En-Gedi. That's on the west coast of the Dead Sea, about halfway between north and south. And it's southeast of Jerusalem. It's down lower. So it would definitely be a threat. And Jehoshaphat feared and set himself to seek unto Jehovah. And he proclaimed a fast throughout all Judah. And Judah gathered themselves together to seek help of Jehovah. Even out of all the cities of Judah, they came to seek Jehovah. One of the interesting things about the... that will come up in just a little bit. And Jehoshaphat stood in the assembly of Judah in Jerusalem, in the house of Jehovah, before the new court. And he said, "O Jehovah, the God of our fathers, art not thou God in heaven? And art not thou ruler over all the kingdoms of the nations? And in thy hand is power and might, so that none is able to withstand thee. Didst not thou, O our God, drive out the inhabitants of this land before thy people Israel, and give it to the seed of Abraham, thy friend, forever? And they dwelt therein, and have built thee a sanctuary therein for thy name," that would be the temple, "saying, if evil come upon us, the sword, judgment, or pestilence, or famine, we will stand before this house, and before thee, for thy name is in this house, and cry unto thee in our affliction, and thou wilt hear and save. And now behold, the children of Ammon, and Moab, and Mount Seir, whom thou wouldest not let Israel invade when they came out of the land of Egypt, but they turned aside from them, and destroyed them not. Behold, how they reward us to come to cast out of thy possession, which thou hast given us to inherit. O our God, wilt thou not judge them? For we have no might against this great company that cometh against us, neither know we what to do, but our eyes are upon thee." And all Judah stood before Jehovah with their little ones and their wives and their children. Okay, we'll pause just a moment here to analyze the situation. Who were Ammon and Moab? What's that? They're kind of close. They were sons of Lot, it would be. So, they were in a way relatives of Israel, relatives of the Lord's people, Judah in this case. If we look at the map, and right in front of me is the Dead Sea here, then we've got Ammon, Moab, and we usually say Esau or Edom. Ammon, sort of northeast from the Dead Sea, and Moab, sort of on the east, and to a little bit on the from the center to the south, and then Edom to the southeast. Now, each of those three tribes got there by ousting a bad people before them. I think it was the Emim and the Zumim for Ammon and Moab. But it was the Edomites, or the Esauites, who ousted the people of Mount Seir. Now it's interesting, it does not say Edom or Esau here, but Mount Seir. Another curious thing is we look in those first couple of verses, it says Ammon, Moab, and some of the children of Ammon. We do not seem to know for sure why it repeats Ammon and some of the Ammonites. But one of the possibilities is that a portion of the Ammonites came down and conquered Esau or Edom. That's one of the possibilities. And so it goes under the name of Mount Seir, the name that was given by the earlier inhabitants. I won't spend a lot of time going down to Genesis 14, but there was a people from the north, a Caucasian type of people, that had come down and conquered Mount Seir. So they are a people, but evidently we're not to think of them exactly as Edomites. But we've got three groups that are against the Lord's people. But there's this is not unusual that there are three against the Lord's people. We can see some other groups in Ehud versus Moab, Ammon, and the Amalekites. We'll come back to that. Now then, we read further from verse 14. Then upon Jehaziel, the son of Zechariah, the son of Benaiah, the son of Jael, the son of Mattaniah, the Levite, of the sons of Asaph. Remember there are several of the Psalms that were Psalms of Asaph. Came the Spirit of Jehovah in the midst of the assembly, and he said, Hearken, ye all Judah, and ye inhabitants of Jerusalem, thou King Jehoshaphat. Thus saith Jehovah unto you, Fear not ye, neither be dismayed by reason of this great multitude, for the battle is not yours, but God's. Tomorrow go ye down against them. Behold, they come up by the ascent of Ziz. That's between En-Gedi, or Hazazon Tamar, and Jerusalem. Now remember that this bunch is by the Dead Sea. They've got to climb the better part of a mile to get up to the land where Jerusalem is. And ye shall find them at the end of the valley, before the wilderness of Jeruel. Ye shall not need to fight in this battle. Set yourselves, stand ye still, and see the salvation of Jehovah with you. That's a phrase that's well worth remembering. Stand ye still and see the salvation of Jehovah with you, O Judah and Jerusalem. Fear not, nor be dismayed. Tomorrow go out against them, for Jehovah is with you. And Jehoshaphat bowed his head with his face to the ground. And all Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem fell down before Jehovah, worshiping Jehovah. That's the goal. That's the thing that the Lord planned to bring them to. And the Levites of the children of the Kohathites and of the children of the Korahites stood up to praise Jehovah, the God of Israel, with an exceeding loud voice. And they rose early in the morning and went forth into the wilderness of Tekoa. Remember, Amos was a herdsman from Tekoa? That's down towards the south. And as they went forth, Jehoshaphat stood and said, Hear me, O Judah, and ye inhabitants of Jerusalem. Believe in Jehovah your God, so shall ye be established. believe his prophets, so shall ye prosper. And when he had taken counsel with the people, he appointed them that should sing unto Jehovah and give praise in holy array as they went out before the army and say, Give thanks unto Jehovah, for his loving kindness endureth forever. Many of the Psalms have that line. And when they began to sing and to praise, Jehovah set liers in wait against the children of Ammon, Moab, and Mount Seir that were come against Judah, and they were smitten. For the children of Ammon and Moab stood up against the inhabitants of Mount Seir, utterly to slay and destroy them. And when they had made an end of the inhabitants of Seir, everyone helped to destroy another. And when Judah came to the watchtower of the wilderness, they looked upon the multitude, and behold, they were dead bodies fallen to the earth, and there was none that escaped. And when Jehoshaphat and his people came to take the spoil of them, they found among them in abundance both riches and dead bodies and precious jewels, which they stripped off for themselves more than they could carry away. And they were 3 days in taking the spoil. It was so much. And on the fourth day they assembled themselves in the valley of Berakah, or the valley of blessing. For there they blessed Jehovah. Therefore the name of that place was called the valley of Berakah unto this day. Then they returned, every man of Judah and Jerusalem, and Jehoshaphat in the forefront of them, to go again to Jerusalem with joy. For Jehovah had made them to rejoice over their enemies. And they came to Jerusalem with psalteries and harps and trumpets unto the house of Jehovah. And the fear of God was on all the kingdoms of the countries when they heard that Jehovah fought against the enemies of Israel. So the realm of Jehoshaphat was quiet, for his God gave him rest round about. Here again, we see these three tribes, the Ammonites, the Moabites, and Mount Seir. Ammon and Moab were the sons of Lot. What's the capital of Jordan today? Amman, that's right. It still has that name from 4,000 years ago. Amman, Jordan, and then Moab and Mount Seir. Well, there's something a little deeper about this incident. We mentioned that there are other places where we have these three tribes that become enemies of the Lord's people in one way or another. We have Gideon versus three tribes, the Midianites, Amalekites, and Arabs, or called sons of the east, or children of the east. We've got three groups there also. And then Solomon against Adonijah, Joab, and Abiathar. Adonijah was his half-brother. Joab was another relative. The one was after the crown. Joab was head of the army. And Abiathar was a priest. So you got all three kinds there. And then in Revelation chapter 16, in connection with the seven last plagues, you go through six of the plagues, and then before you get to the seventh, it tells about three unclean spirits. Well, in our lesson, we want to figure out what it is that the Lord is trying to teach us here. There's one thing that the other incident against three enemies doesn't have. whether it's the incident with Ehud, the judge, or a later judge, Gideon, or these three unclean spirits. This account tells us that of the three enemies, first one of them is to go down, and then the other two battle each other until they destroy themselves. We're not specifically told that in the other accounts. Like with Gideon, you have Gideon's 300, and then they are divided into three groups, presumably 100 in each group, because he got three enemies. I also had three ways of escape. Now, what could these enemies be or represent, and how does it affect us today? What do you think are the enemies of the Lord's people today? Or perhaps the three unclean spirits? If I were living... Yes, Teresa. Those are definitely our personal three enemies. But now let's look at it on a world scale. And what kind of enemies do we see? Or attitudes, or religio-political? Yes. Okay, atheism and leftism seem to be pretty well combined. But, right, we've got the leftism, atheism versus the Islam. Those are totally incompatible, but nevertheless, they're cooperating for now to try to get rid of Christians in Israel, or hate whitey and hate all Jews. And yet there's one more enemy. And that's the more... Yes, land. That's right. No question about that. Well, somebody told a story once about the hunter who went out looking for a bear. And as he comes around a tree, coming around the other side of the tree is a big black bear. And the hunter pulls up his gun to shoot, and the bear speaks. Says, "Wait a minute, why do you want to shoot me?" Says, "Well, I'm looking for a fur coat." Well, he says, "After all, now, you know, I'm only looking to satisfy my appetite. Let's talk about this and negotiate." So hunter set aside his gun, and they negotiated, and pretty soon they each had what they wanted. The bear satisfied his appetite, and the man was inside a fur coat. And that illustrates the point of what happens if Israel puts aside its defenses. Why is the whole world against Israel? Well, there's more than one reason, but one basic reason is, if my nation is a whole lot guiltier than Israel, I've got to do some kind of accusing of Israel to justify myself. If I'm doing really badly to my own people, I have to have a foreign enemy. And, of course, there's another thing to consider, too. When Israel came out of Egypt at the time of the Exodus, what nation was it that helped Israel to come out? That's the answer. None. Because if any nation had helped Israel to come out of Egypt, they would have taken the credit for it, wouldn't they? So what is happening today? How many friends does Israel have in the world today, as far as nations are concerned? And which one would that be, Land? At best. And it seems pretty clear that the present government is pro-Israel in words, but not in deeds. There used to be, just a year ago, down to just two heads of state that were openly pro-Israel. And the Prime Minister of Canada got unelected. Down to just one. And big surprise is which one it is. It's Angela Merkel in Germany. But then she's also letting in these Syrian so-called refugees. So what does that mean about the future of Germany? We see the point. If even one nation were left that was pro-Israel when the time comes, that nation would take the credit for Israel's survival. So it seems evident from the time of the Exodus, the only one who can get the credit for saving Israel, that's right, Jehovah God and Him alone. And the only one that will be able to be credited for delivering Israel at the present time is going to be Jehovah God and Him alone. So we sort of get the idea. But now we take a look at these enemies. We've got two of them. We've got the atheist left, and we've got Islam, but there's a third one that's older than either atheism, leftism, or Islam. And what one would that be? Connected with Satan, all right. Cain, what was the fall of paganism? Yeah. That was certainly contrary to it. When did paganism fall? What was...
Well, I'm guessing ancient Israel's exercising their relationship with God. That would be my guess.
Okay. And yet that wouldn't make them a third enemy, would it? Yeah. That's right. Okay, what was the fall of paganism? Who caused the fall of pagan Rome? And Christians, yes, that's right. And how was the Christian movement taken over? By the papacy, that's right. Now, of course, it split two ways because the Eastern Orthodox couldn't take them anymore somewhere just after 1000 A.D. So the three enemies are Catholicism, then Islam, and then leftist atheism. Could these perhaps fit the three enemies of the Lord's people at this end of the age? It's worth considering. And if that's the case, what do we see? And I said that's if that's the case. So let's watch. Which ones are going up and which ones are coming down at the present time? I think it's... Yes, Teresa. I think that's as I would see it too. Now, barring any surprises in the next several years or few decades, whatever it is, it's just possible that what we're being shown here in Jehoshaphat's time is that first, leftism and Islam will gang together as opposite as they are, as incompatible as they may be, they are both joining forces to get rid of anything called Christian or Israel. Now, we do see what's called Christianity going down, but we do not see Israel going down, do we? Now, just a little side note here. Yeah, we have time to just divert a little bit. Israel was absent from the land for how many years? 18 centuries, a little bit more than 18 centuries from the land. When they went into Egypt and came out, the Lord told them, remember when you were in bondage in Egypt, and so be kind to the strangers. Israel was in diaspora, dispersion for over 1,800 years, by a little. And during that time, has it softened the hearts of every last Jew in the world? No, not every last one. But sometimes you may see on the YouTube that there was a leader of the Hamas, and his son has converted to Christianity. There was another leader of the people inside Gaza, the ones that hate Israel, and the child was seriously defective and wounded. It was the Israelis that took care of him in the hospital and brought him back to a semblance of health. The son of a mortal enemy of Israel. So the heart of Israel, from what we see, is being softened. Now, just projecting into the kingdom a little bit now. What will it be like when Arabs who had been Muslims before are resurrected? And now Abraham says, you need to appeal to Jerusalem for help. What other nation would be so merciful to them? Especially when they'll have the greatest government that this world has ever known, with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and Moses and David and Daniel. So it appears that what we are being shown here is that atheism, leftism, and Islam may be ganging together to get rid of Christianity. And when they have put it down, then the atheist left will invade the Islamic countries, and that will be that will precipitate Armageddon. Now, I have said this before. If that is the way it works out, there is a consolation prize for the Christian. And that is, if Armageddon is brought out by leftism versus Islam, the world will not be able to blame Christ for Armageddon. Now, what we look forward to is, of course, the kingdom to follow. Now, when the other three groups had managed to destroy themselves, first the inhabitants of Mount Seir, and then Ammon versus Moab, then Jehoshaphat and company see all of these vast treasures that these three armies had brought with them. and they take of the treasures. Do we have other incidents where this has taken place? Well, it seems to me there's a significant one, I guess, when the Amalekites were beaten and they had fled and they took the treasures. The one that particularly comes to my mind is at the time of the Exodus, when, remember, they were to, some translations say borrow, others say, probably more correctly, they were to ask of the Egyptians for silver and gold and such things. Well, after all, why not? The Egyptians are saying, just get out of here. Get out, get out. Oh, wait a minute now. We have our houses here. We have our lands here. And you want us to get out? They're worth more than a little. In fact, with the demand so high for us to get out now, and maybe the price should be a little higher. So, they were to ask of the Egyptians gold and silver and such things. The King James says they spoiled the Egyptians. American Standard says it a little bit better. They despoiled the Egyptians. Now, what might this mean to us? They despoiled the Egyptians. Armageddon comes and Armageddon goes. What are the things that the world in Christ's kingdom will be able to salvage from the present age? Any ideas? Ah, I heard the word technology. I think that's right. I know the question has come up more than once over 50 or 60 years that I'm aware of, that what will it be like in Christ's kingdom? Will it be advanced technology, or will everybody go back to just his own vine and fig tree? And this sort of suggests to us that they despoiled the Egyptians. They took whatever was of value. Or here, they took the treasures, that the technology will not be lost. And I realize I'm diverting a little bit from the subject. But remember how it says, they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Now there's another scripture that says, beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears. That's right. It's the context. They are spoken, but prophesied of different times. Today, they are beating their plowshares into swords and H-bombs and missiles. But in the kingdom, evidently, these things will not simply be lost and buried. But maybe you can convert a tank in... What can you do with a tank? What's that? Ah, yeah. Tanks can be converted into bulldozers. And similarly, the thought concerning beating the pruning hooks, spears into pruning hooks, that instead of implements of war against one another, it will be for the growing of agriculture, for the feeding of the people. Do you think there will be a serious work in feeding the people as they come back? That's right. And best guess from the way rate at which the Jews have been coming back to Israel is somewhere between 2 and 4% increase in the population during the early part of the kingdom. And if it's 2% that will be what the resurrection rate brings back, even if the population at the end of Armageddon were reduced to just 1 billion people from 7 billion now, I don't think it'll be anything like nearly that low. But suppose it were. How long would it take to resurrect all of the people to a population of 30 billion or perhaps 60 billion? Turns out it would only take a little over 200 years to do the job. And if they return at the rate of 4%, it'll be barely over 100 years to get all the people in the world who have ever lived back in the land. It also means you got to increase the food production, doesn't it? When the people come back, it'll be kind of like as it is in Israel when the refugees come and so many of them have nothing to start with. So first, you got to feed them. Second, you've got to train them. Then third, you can put them out and found new communities in the Negev or wherever. Now then, these three enemies. Let's look at Revelation chapter 16, where again we have three enemies. By the way, I'm still struggling with this one. So it's a case of, we'll do the best we can at this point in time. Now we have Revelation chapter 16. The seven last plagues. For a little context, going back into chapter 15, it speaks of the temple being opened. That's interesting. If we go back to the time of Solomon, it makes mention in between chapters 6 through 8 that the temple is dedicated on the seventh month, probably the first day of the month at the new moon. But it is not completed until the eighth month, presumably again the first day of the month. So the temple back then was dedicated in the month before it was completed. I know my first thought in thinking about that was, hey, is that reality? Well, if we had a literal temple, or like for that matter a business office, you could start to use a part of the facility before the whole thing was completed. You wouldn't need the janitor's office to be completed by the time that you're ready to open up the auditorium for use for the people. And so it's not at all unusual. In fact, that's probably more the rule, that you can dedicate the facility to use the main parts before every last little bit is completed. But it makes mention in the erection of the temple that it was dedicated and smoke entered the temple so that no man could enter the temple the reason for it was so that the priests could not stand to minister. Well, I'll suggest what that seems to mean. It was Brother Fowler a good many years ago that suggested it, and I've concluded that it makes sense that the resurrection of the sleeping saints is not sufficient for the priesthood to bless the whole world. Not yet. Then we come to Revelation. In Revelation 15, the temple is opened and smoke fills the temple so that no man could come into the temple. until the seven last plagues were fulfilled. And we get down to that seventh last plague, and it opens with, "It is done." Does that sound kind of like some familiar words, Teresa? That is right. It is finished. Okay, so we come down through these seven last plagues, and not until we get to the seventh and last plague is the church completed. The church is opened, or the first members of those that have fallen asleep in death, probably the vast majority, they are raised first. And then one by one, the other saints are completed, finish their courses, until just at the beginning of Armageddon, the last one finishes his course and is raised. So now, if we go to Revelation 16:3, this now is the second, this is American Standard Version, "And the second poured out his bowl into the sea, and it became blood as of a dead man. And every living soul died, even the things that were in the sea." Oops, I think I wanted the second verse. "The first went and poured out his bowl into the earth, and it became a noisome and grievous sore upon the men that had the mark of the beast and that worshipped his image." It's not quite the last mention of the image of the beast. We have it already begun in the 13th chapter. And I'll mention that in chapter 12, we have information about the true church until the second advent. In Revelation 13, we have information about the false church state until the second advent. And then in Revelation 14, we have the second advent and the harvest. So the image of the beast is created long ago. I would suggest that that goes back to the time of the Reformation or before. But this is perhaps the last time that we are given information on the image of the beast as to how long it lasts. Curious thing is, in Revelation 19:20, who is it that's destroyed? It's not the dragon, that's Satan. But it is the beast, and not the image of the beast, but the false prophet. The false prophet is mentioned in only three places. Revelation 16:13, which we'll read, 19:20, and 20, verse 10. I think those are the only places that the false prophet is mentioned. Now, the image of the beast we see here at the time of the first plague. And then we come down to Revelation 16:20. Is that correct? 16:13. That should be it. "The 12th has the pouring out of the bowl upon the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up." To me, it sounds like it might be symbolic of a depression, but I don't think we have time to go into that further. The purpose was that the way might be made ready for the kings that come from the east. Literally, the kings that come from the sun rising, as the ASV has it. "And I saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet." No image of the beast mentioned here. Three unclean spirits. And again, this can be the hard right, the hard left, and Islam. Now, just because leftist atheism as headed by Russia these days, probably continuing into Armageddon, it doesn't mean that the hard right is our friend. The Lord has declared his opposition to the hard right. And it looks like that is the first one to be destroyed. If it is not the first one to lose its influence and power, and it participates in creating Armageddon, then the world might be tempted to blame Christ for Armageddon. So it seems like the Lord has closed the door on that option, and we are watching its continual decrease, diminishing. One more little tidbit here. These are the spirits, this is now the 14th verse. They are the spirits of demons. So all three, hard left, hard right, Islam, are the spirits of demons, working signs which go forth unto the kings of the whole world to gather them together unto the war of the great day of God the Almighty. Now it's interesting. Well, Islamicists are beheading people, destroying Christians. The Western press virtually ignores it. But let Israel do one thing in defense, and it's broadcast as Israeli aggression. We know where this is coming from, don't we? Okay. Now then, here's this interesting parenthetical, verse 15. Behold, I come as a thief. Blessed is he that watcheth and keepeth his garments, lest he walk naked and they see his shame. We go back to the Exodus. Now, where did the time go? Well, we have this picture in the Exodus of the period of the plagues representing this present evil world, and in particular the Gospel Age portion of it. But then Israel leaves Egypt. They're free from the influence of Pharaoh for 3 days, it is, to picture the millennial kingdom. And then Pharaoh goes after them to picture the little season. Pharaoh is destroyed, and then they go do what they're called to do from the very start. They go 3 days' journey in the wilderness to serve the Lord their God. Okay. Well, now we come through the first 9 plagues. The first 3 fall on Israel and Egypt. But the last 7 are different. They fall only on the Egyptians. The Lord has severed between the Egyptians and the Israelites. And Moses now takes the dominant role. We get down to the last plague. And what was the preparation that night? The Passover lamb was slain. Oh, wait a minute. I got to scratch my dandruff on this one. That I thought Christ is our Passover. He is. That's right. But how can you wait until the church is complete in order to slay the Passover lamb? But it's kind of like in the first chapter of Revelation. First, it tells us that the first advent of Christ is necessary for the deliverance of the people. And then it says the second advent is necessary for the deliverance of the people. In the plagues in Egypt, we have the Passover sacrifice. At the last day, it's something we memorialize, and that's coming soon. So it's showing us that the first advent work of Christ is essential to the deliverance of the Lord's people, firstborn and everybody else too. And then here in Revelation 16, verse 15, it's reminding us just before that last plague that the second advent of Christ is essential to the deliverance of the people into the thousand-year kingdom of Christ. Now, do I know that my identification of these three is correct? And the answer is no. The only way I can know is by keeping my eyes open and watching. And we'll be talking about light versus darkness in our study for the second meeting.